We are going to be looking at least at the beginning, the story of Deborah and Barak. It's a story that a lot of people remember, in part because it involves a woman who is both a prophetess and a judge. You don't find leading women very much in the Old Testament scriptures. She didn't fight the battle. That was left to Barak. But she did travel with the army to lend in support. And because of Barak's unwillingness to go without Deborah, to step up and say, yes, I will do what the Lord said, the blow that killed the commander of the Canaanite army, who was Sisera, went to a woman who was married to a Canaanite. Wasn't even an Israel, somebody who was fully of an Israelite nation. She might have been an Israelite, but at least her husband was a Kenite. It was a tremendous victory because the Canaanites had the advantage all the way through. They had the military technology that the Israelites didn't at this time. They had 900 iron chariots. The Israelites, though, fought on foot. Now, if you'd ever thought about trying to attack a iron chariot, while you're on foot, you can see that's a little bit difficult. But the Israelites won a total, complete victory over this invading army, the Canaanite army. If you take a look at Judges chapter 4, Judges chapter 4, and starting with verse 14, Deborah said to Barak, arise, for this day which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you. So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. The Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his armies with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Hesheroth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not even one was left. Think about what a total rout that was. There was not an enemy soldier left other than Sisera, who was on the run. It was a complete wipe. It's interesting, too, because we find additional information about them when we read through the song that was written. Deborah and Barak afterwards composed a song to commemorate the deed. And it's in Judges chapter 5. But in that song, we find some other things that are not mentioned in the text itself, or the account of the battle. In Judges chapter 5 and verse 8, Judges chapter 5 and verse 8. I got 6 up there for some reason. It says, the new gods were chosen when the war was in the gates. Not a shield or a spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. While they had an army of 40,000, only 10,000 actually went to battle. But they were undermanned in the sense that they didn't have the equipment. They didn't have a shield or a spear among all those people. And yet they still won. It was a voluntary army as well. Take a look at verse 9. My heart goes out to the commanders of Israel, the volunteers among the people, bless the Lord. These were not trained soldiers. These were not people that had been living a battle life all their life. These were people who decided they would step up because God called and would go to battle with God and for their homeland. What's also interesting, it was composed of the tribes of Issachar, Zebulun, and Naphtali. Those were the tribes that are up in the northern corner of Israel. They're smaller tribes. if you actually read a lot of the battles and accounts of most of the battles of Israel, those tribes are not very much mentioned because they were small, they didn't have very many numbers. This was the out of the way group that was actually fighting this battle. In fact, you wonder what happened to the big tribes, the ones that were usually involved in most of the battles. And you look down at chapter 5 and look at verse 15. It says, the princes of Issachar were with Deborah, as was Issachar, so was Barak. Into the valleys they rushed at his heels. Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great resolves of heart. Why do you sit among the sheepfolds? To hear the piping of the flocks. Among the divisions of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart. Gilead remained across the Jordan. And why did Dan stay in ships? Asher sat at the seashore and remained by his landing. Zebulun was a people who despised their lives even to death, and Naphtali also on the high places of the field. She starts listing out what happened to Gad and what happened to Reuben. Reuben was contemplating thinking about going. He thought it was a good idea, but he never got around to going. Gad just stayed on the other side. It was too busy. Dan was off on the seas and just never bothered coming off the ships. Asher was too busy with their fishing industry. They didn't get involved. Perhaps we can excuse them because it was far away from their home, at least some of them, but not all of them. But what's really interesting is there's one town that's mentioned is Mizor. And it didn't have an excuse. It's in chapter 5, verse 23. Curse Mirzah, who said the angel of the Lord, utterly curse his inhabitants, because they did not come to the help of the Lord, to help the Lord against the warriors. We have no idea where Mirzah is. We don't know what happened to it. We don't know where it was located. But most people believe it must have been among where the three tribes that actually came to battle was located. Of those of Naphtali, Zebulun, and Issachar, this one town didn't answer the call. People were risking their lives to fight, and one town decided not to help. And it's an interesting way it is worded there. If you notice that what they said is, they didn't come to the help of the Lord. Well, God doesn't need help fighting battles, does he? But they didn't help God. God can fight battles on his own, but he wants people there, involved. And these people didn't go. And they were cursed. And that's probably why we don't know where Mirzah is. It's gone. It was cursed by an angel of God. And there's something that we need to learn from this. Those who don't join are against. In fact, that's what Jesus said in Luke chapter 11. In Luke chapter 11, and in verse 23. Luke chapter 11, and in verse 23. Says, he who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters. There are responsibilities which we have, which cannot be ignored, nor can it be neglected. See, Jesus came to do battle against Satan. If you look at the verses before this, back in chapter 11, verse 14, and he was casting out a demon, and it was a mute. When the demon was gone out, the mute man spoke, and the crowds were amazed. But some of them said, he cast out demon by Beelzebub, the ruler of demons. There were people there who tried to deny Christ by impugning on his character. They denied that God was actually involved. And they tried to slander the Lord. Yes, a miracle occurred before them. A man who could not speak now could speak. It must have been by the power of Satan. As if Satan was interested in making things better in people's lives. But notice that some also reacted in a different way in verse 16. Others, to test him, were demanding of him a sign from heaven. He just healed a man who was mute. Well, prove it that it was really from God. I want to see a sign from heaven. Let's prove that it was really from God. That was proof from God. But because they did not support Christ, that's where we have Christ's conclusion. He who is not with me is against me. In a sense, they were indifferent to the Lord. In Matthew chapter 11, verse 23. And you, Capernaum, will not be exalted to heaven, will you? You will descend to Hades, for if the miracles had occurred in Sodom, which occurred in you, it would remain to this day. Nevertheless, I say to you that it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you. Those miracles that Jesus did were in Capernaum, where they were accusing him of doing it by the power of Satan. Jesus points out, if all those miracles had happened in Sodom, the town that we associate with the most corrupt, the most evil, the one that God wiped out that is now a synonym for evil. If those miracles had occurred in Sodom, they would have changed. What does that say about Capernaum? And it didn't change. See, the neglect to follow is not because of a lack of evidence, but it's a denial of God. Because isn't that what Mirza did, that town? They didn't answer God's call that came through Barak and Deborah. They denied that God wanted them to do something. They neglected their duty. And always so easy to let that happen. It's so easy to let other people do things. After all, I have so much to do. I got so many things on my plate that I just don't have time. Kind of like those tribes that just didn't quite make it over to the battle. Now, there's no denying we have limited time. We don't have all the time in the world that we would like to have. In Psalms chapter 90, starting with verse 10. As for the days of our life, they are contained 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow, for soon it is gone, and we fly away. Who understands the power of your anger and the fury according to the fear that is due you? So teach us to number our days that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. Do we have a lot of time? The answer is no. Every once in a while I start adding up, how many more years do I think I got to go? And I'm sitting there going, you know, I don't have very many left. Not compared to what I used to have. I'm thinking all the things I'd like to get done before I go. And you know what I realize is that I'm not going to get it all done. There's just no way. But the point that the psalmist is trying to make is, if we understand God's anger and God's wrath at sin, we better number our days. We better put some priorities on it. We have limited time. So why waste it on things in this world when we're not going to stay around here anyway? Because where we put our priorities show our focus. In Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 16. Ephesians chapter 5. And in verse 16. It says, making the most of your time because the days are evil. We got to make the most of it. We got to redeem them. We don't have that much time, so what we do have, we have to make it to the best use that we have. But what most people do is they only offer to God what's convenient. What is easy to do. Well, I don't have anything else to do, so okay, I'll go ahead and do something for the Lord. But in Romans chapter 12, Romans chapter 12, we're told, therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. What is our duty as Christians? We're here to serve God. In Ecclesiastes, Solomon said there that the whole duty of man is to serve God and keep his commandments. That's everything about why we are here. And yet we get so wrapped up in other things. Small things. Temporary things. And we end up neglecting what we are here for. And then we see the religious world around us and look at its indifference. Have you ever noticed, if you look at some of the, especially the big denominations in the area, look at it sometime, they'll tell you how many members they have. And you look at it and you say, how could they possibly have that many people? Yeah, I know they have a big building, but how do they fit them all in that building? Then we'll go look at how many actually attend services. And you realize how they fit them all in that building. They claim a whole lot more than actually attend. And that's basically because that's the way the denominations look at it. They view it as, well, at least if you give some occasional service, well, that's pretty good from their point of view. So is it any wonder sometimes that same lazy attitude creeps into the church? In Matthew chapter 12, Matthew 12 and in verse 30, Matthew 12 verse 30, it says, he who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters. If you're not a part of the church, then you're against it. If you're not doing things for the Lord, you're working against Him. See, one of the problems, I think, that comes from a neglect of doing what we know we ought to do, is a lot of times we don't fear the results. We're really not that scared about the fact that we didn't do all that we could. So often I hear people say, well, I know I ought to, but... And they'll come up with something. There's always something. But in James chapter 4, James chapter 4 and in verse 17, James 4 verse 17, therefore to the one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. If we understand what we need to do, we have no excuse anymore. We understand what needs to be happening, and we just sit back and let somebody else do it. We have no excuse. Jesus pointed out that ignoring God is not something that will be ignored. Take a look at Luke chapter 12. Just because you ignored God doesn't mean He turns around and ignores you too. Luke 12, starting with verse 42. The Lord said, "Who then is the faithful and sensible steward whom his master will put in charge of his servants to give them their rations at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that slave says in his heart, 'My master will be a long time in coming,' and begins to beat the slaves, both men and women, and to eat and drink and getting drunk, the master or the slave will come on a day when he does not expect them, and at an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and sign him a place with the unbelievers. And that slave who knew his master's will and yet did not get ready or act in accord with his will receive many lashes. But the one who does not know it and committed deeds worthy of a flogging will receive but a few. For from everyone who has been given, much will be required, and to the one whom they entrust much of him will they ask all the more." Notice what he's saying there. If you know what you're supposed to do and you do not make any preparation at all, of course you're going to get punished for it. Not only for the fact that you didn't do what you were supposed to do, but also because you were lazy about it. See, what Jesus came was to light a fire under people. In fact, look at verse 49, the very next verse. "I have come to cast fire upon the earth, and how I wish it were already kindled." Jesus was here to turn up the heat, to get people moving. And how dare we try to put a damper on it? Blessings come from doing God's will, not from sitting back and watching other people do it. In John chapter 13, and in verse 37, John 13, starting with verse 37, Peter said to him, "Lord, why can I not follow you right now? I would lay down my life for you." Oops, I got the wrong verse here again. Well, I have no... Hold on just a second. See if my usual mistakes. It had to do with doing the word. Well, I got the wrong verse there. We'll go on to the next one because that one definitely is right. James chapter 1. I'll find that one later. James chapter 1, verse 21. I'll blame it on my cold. How is that? Yes. If you know these things, you are blessed if you do them. Yes, that is the verse that I wanted. Thank you. You're blessed, you're happy if you do them. You know what you need to do, but happiness doesn't come until you actually put them to practice. In James chapter 1, James chapter 1 and verse 21, says, therefore, putting aside all filthiness and all the remains of wickedness, in humility receive the word implanted, which is able to save your souls. But prove yourselves doers of the word, and not merely hearers who delude themselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who looks at his natural face in a mirror. For once he has looked at himself and has gone away, he has immediately forgotten what kind of person he was. But one who looks intently at the perfect law, the law of liberty, and abides by it, not having become a forgetful hearer, but an effectual doer, this man will be blessed in what he does. Happiness comes by doing. We have to put that word into practice. Otherwise we forget it. We don't see ourselves accurately anymore. I want you to think about that this morning. Are you going to be blessed because of the efforts you do? Or are you going to be like Mirza, where your efforts curse you because of your neglect? There's an opportunity this day, if there's anyone here who's not yet a child of God, to do what is required of you, to become a child of God, to put on Christ. If there's anyone here who is a child of God and would like the prayers of the brethren on behalf, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song that was selected by you?